Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling, well, a really important task, actually. We're trying to correct one of the biggest misunderstandings in philosophy, maybe even economics. We're diving into Adam Smith's 1759 masterpiece, The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
It really is his foundational text, isn't it? And honestly, it's the one that shows you who Adam Smith really was. So many people just know him as, you know, the Wealth of Nations guy, the father of capitalism, talking about the invisible hand and self-interest.
Right.
But if you take that economic stuff without this moral context, well, you just fundamentally misunderstand what he was getting at.
Exactly. This book gives us the ethical, the psychological framework that really underpins everything else he wrote. So our mission today is to distill the core of Smith's argument here. And maybe answer a pretty fundamental question for all of us. How do we figure out what's right and wrong? Where does our conscience actually come from?
And Smith's answer was, well, pretty revolutionary for his time. You know, back then, the thinking often leaned on divine command, or maybe pure logic, cold reason. Smith came along and argued that morality is, maybe surprisingly, grounded in very human things. Mm-hmm. Emotion and social interaction. It all starts with this innate feeling he called sympathy.
Okay, let's unpack that shift. Before we dive into the ideas, though, let's talk a bit about the man himself. Adam Smith, 1723 to 1790, a major figure of the Scottish Enlightenment.
Yeah, he was a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow. And the theory of moral sentiments essentially came out of his lectures there. It really shows he wasn't just doing abstract philosophy in ivory tower. He was kind of obsessed with observing how people actually behaved.
Like a social scientist almost.
Exactly. Maybe the first great social psychologist. And like you said earlier, this book just completely flips that common caricature of Smith, you know, the champion of just pure, unrestrained self-interest. That idea really doesn't hold up when you read this.
Not at all.
He was primarily focused on the moral foundations, the constraints, really, that make a decent society. And yes, free markets possible. He starts right out of the gate saying, how selfish soever a man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others. Basically, we're built to care about each other. Fellow feeling is innate.
So, okay, if morality isn't just imposed from God or worked out like a math problem, where does it come from? What's the engine driving the theory of moral sentiments?
Well, the central idea is that morality is kind of an emergent property of our emotional and social lives. It starts with sympathy. And for Smith, sympathy isn't just pity. It's this imaginative ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes and feel a version of what they're feeling.
Right. It's crucial to get that distinction. It's fellow feeling. Like if I win the lottery, I don't just want you to feel sorry for my previous poverty. I want you to share my joy.
Right? Exactly. Or if you trip and fall, you want sympathy for your embarrassment, not just pity for your scraped knee. And we use this mechanism constantly to judge others. We instinctively ask ourselves, can I enter into or sympathize with the feelings and motivations behind their actions? If we can find that shared feeling, that mutual sympathy, we approve. That shared resonance is what he calls propriety.
Okay, so the book kind of takes us on this journey. Mm-hmm. Starts with that basic sympathetic feeling, then we use it to judge others. And this feels like the really key step, we turn that judgment back on ourselves.
That's the big psychological leap. We internalize all this social feedback. And over time, we hopefully stop relying just on what the people around us think at that moment. Mm. We start consulting this internal judge, someone objective, fair, informed, what Smith famously calls the impartial spectator.
The man within the breast. So that's our conscience. It's built from society, but then it becomes sort of independent of immediate social pressure.
Precisely. Morality for Smith is this bottom-up thing. It's emotional resonance, social calibration, and it all culminates in that inner voice. It explains how you can know something is wrong even when you're totally alone.
Let's dig into the mechanics a bit more. So when we're judging feelings, we're looking for propriety. You said that's about proportionality. How does that work?
Yeah, propriety is finding that kind of sweet spot of emotional response. If someone, say, spills coffee on their shirt, a minor thing, and they burst into tears and wail for an hour, well, you probably can't sympathize with that level of grief, right?
All right. It feels excessive, disproportionate.
Exactly. The sentiment is way out of line with the cause, so we disapprove of the expression of the feeling, even if we understand the initial annoyance.
And Smith notes, we even do this to ourselves, don't we? We kind of tone down our own strong emotions in public because we want others to be able to sympathize with us.
Yes. We instinctively dial things back to a level we think a reasonable, impartial observer could share. That moderation, that effort to make our feelings relatable, that's the first step towards what he calls self-command.
Okay, so that's judging feelings propriety. What about judging actions? This is where merit and demerit come in, right? Judging whether actions deserve reward or punishment.
Correct. Merit isn't just about having the right motives. The action also needs to have generally beneficial consequences. But perhaps the most critical distinction Smith makes here, especially for society, is between justice and beneficence.
This feels really important, particularly if we're thinking about, say, the role of government or law.
Absolutely fundamental. Justice, for Smith, is what he calls a perfect duty. It basically means don't harm others. Protect their life, their property, their basic rights. It's the absolute baseline, the non-negotiable requirement for society to even exist.
He calls it the main pillar, holding everything up.
Exactly. Pull that pillar out and the whole structure collapses into atoms, as he puts it. And because it's so essential, it can and must be enforced by law. We need rules against theft, violence, fraud.
Okay, so that's justice. What about beneficence? Things like kindness, charity, generosity.
That's an imperfect duty. It's highly praiseworthy, absolutely. Smith calls it the ornament that beautifies society. But crucially, it cannot be compelled by force or law.
Why not? Isn't being kind good?
It is good, but Smith argues you can't force someone to be kind or generous without violating their liberty. You can't legislate that I must like my neighbor or that I must donate a certain amount to charity. That crosses a line.
I see. So we accept laws telling us not to steal justice, but we'd resist laws telling us we have to volunteer every Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Compelled beneficence.
Precisely that tension. A just society, for Smith, focuses on enforcing the negative rules, don't harm allowing the positive virtues, like kindness, to flourish voluntarily.
Let's circle back to the psychological core then. The impartial spectator. We internalize society's judgment. But hang on, if it's just built from what society thinks, isn't our morality just conformity? Where is the objective standard?
That's a really sharp question, and it's where the concept gets its real depth. The spectator isn't just a mirror of current public opinion. As we mature morally, our goal shifts. We stop just seeking external praise, you know, likes, applause, popularity, which is often fickle and can be manipulated. And we start seeking to be genuinely praiseworthy. We start comparing ourselves not just to the actual people around us, but to what a truly fair, well-informed, impartial observer would think. We hold ourselves to that idealized standard.
Ah, so it's not just about what gets you claps on social media today. It's about being the kind of person that this idealized, wise, internal judge would actually approve of, even if no one else notices.
Exactly. That's mature morality. That's self-command. It's the ultimate internal regulator.
Which brings us neatly to part four, where Smith connects this moral psychology to economics, talking about utility and that famous concept, the invisible hand. He uses the parable of the poor man's son, right?
Yes, this is fascinating stuff. Smith acknowledges that usefulness or utility plays a role in how we view things, but he argues our moral approval comes primarily from sympathizing with the motive. Now, the poor man's son. This is a story about someone who relentlessly chases wealth and status.
But not purely for the stuff itself.
Not primarily. He sacrifices his ease, his health, his peace of mind, chasing wealth because he believes the admiration and respect that come with wealth will finally make him happy. He's chasing the status symbols, the trinkets and baubles, as Smith calls them. It's driven by what Smith terms a kind of deception.
A deception because the wealth itself won't actually bring the deep happiness he imagines.
Right. He's sacrificing real comfort for an illusion of happiness derived from other people's perceived admiration. But here's the genius part, the invisible hand connection in this context. This relentless, maybe even slightly misguided ambition drives him to be incredibly productive.
How so?
Well, to achieve that status, he has to innovate, build things, cultivate land, employ people. He's driven by a fundamentally selfish desire for admiration, but in the process, he creates jobs, produces goods, distributes necessities, things he would likely not distribute so widely if he were just rationally maximizing his own leisure.
Ah, so his drive to accumulate and impress, inadvertently, spreads benefits throughout society. The rich guy can't possibly consume all the grain his vast fields produce, so it gets distributed.
Precisely. The invisible hand here is guiding his self-interested ambition, fueled by this psychological need for approval, toward outcomes that benefit society as a whole, even though that wasn't his intention at all.
Wow. That really complicates the picture of self-interest, doesn't it?
Mm.
It suggests that even ambition we might see as vain or selfish can have unintended positive consequences.
It absolutely does. It makes you rethink the engines of progress. Okay, let's try and pull together the key themes from all this. First, clearly, sympathy as the emotional basis of morality. The big takeaway here for everyday life is maybe, when you're in a conflict, try focusing first on understanding the other person's perspective. And motives, try to sympathize rather than just jumping to judge the outcome.
That makes sense. It's more productive. Okay, theme two. Conscience is developed, not innate. The impartial spectator isn't something we're born with. It's built through social interaction. What does that imply? Maybe that moral growth needs community.
Yeah, I think it does. It suggests continuous social engagement, exposure to different viewpoints is vital. Smith implies that isolation actually hinders moral development because you lose that external feedback loop needed to shape and refine your internal spectator.
Okay. Theme three, the imperative of justice. We talked about this justice as the absolute bedrock. Protecting rights, avoiding harm, it's non-negotiable. Everything else, like economic activity or even voluntary kindness, relies on that stable foundation.
Couldn't function without it.
And finally, theme four, the love of praiseworthiness over praise. This feels incredibly relevant today. Smith's teaching us that mature morality means living up to our internal standards, the impartial spectator's view, rather than constantly chasing external validation, likes, or approval.
Yeah, it's a powerful challenge. Are you acting for the immediate audience or for that deeper internal sense of what's truly right? Acting for the camera or for the man within?
Smith was such a great writer, too. Some of his lines really stick with you. We should probably touch on a few key quotes or ideas that capture this.
Definitely. We already mentioned that opening line about fellow feeling being innate, challenging pure selfishness. And his description of how we judge ourselves is so clear. We can never survey our own sentiments unless we remove ourselves and endeavor to view them as at a certain distance from us. That is the impartial spectator creating psychological distance.
And that powerful image for justice. Justice is the main pillar that upholds the whole edifice if removed. The immense fabric of human society must in a moment crumble into atoms. You really get the sense of its absolute necessity.
My personal favorite, though, might be his warning about the man of system. He criticizes those social reformers, you know, the central planners, who think they can arrange people in society like pieces on a great chessboard.
Right. Forgetting that each piece has its own desires, its own motivations.
Exactly. Forgetting that every individual has a principle of motion of its own. It's such a profound argument for respecting individual agency and a warning against top-down control that ignores human nature.
That respect for the individual seems to flow right out of his whole moral system. Okay, so how do we make this practical? How can we use these ideas day to day?
Well, on a personal level, actively use the impartial spectator. Before you react emotionally, maybe before sending that angry email or responding in a tense meeting, just pause. Ask yourself, how would a fair, reasonable, well-informed person who knows my motives and the whole situation view this? It's a fantastic tool for self-command, for emotional regulation.
That's actually really practical. What about in, say, leadership or social situations?
For leaders dealing with conflict, definitely try to embody that impartial spectator. Be consistent, be fair, apply the same standards transparently. That builds way more trust than just wielding authority. And for broader social issues, keep that justice versus beneficence distinction in mind. Government's primary role. Enforce justice, rigorously prevent harm, protect rights, ensure fair dealing. But maybe we should be cautious about legally mandating beneficence. Let kindness, charity, community spirit flourish voluntarily. Trust people's natural sympathy once justice provides the framework.
As we wrap up reflecting on this, What surprised me most, I think, was just how integrated Smith's thinking was. Psychology, ethics, economics, it all fits together. And the idea that conscience isn't some external rule book, but this natural capacity we develop through living together. That feels quite profound.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, the really sticky insight is that dual nature of ambition we saw in The Poor Man's Son. The idea that our sometimes, frankly, selfish desires for approval, for status, can be channeled by this invisible hand of social and psychological mechanisms into creating public good, often unintentionally. It reveals a complex, maybe messy, but ultimately often beneficial hidden logic to society.
It definitely makes you think about our motivations. Are we chasing the substance or just the appearance? Are we trying to be good or just look good? And which audience matters more, the crowd outside or the spectator within?
Exactly. And that leads us to a final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Take a moment today and consider where you tend to rely more on external praise-seeking likes, compliments, status symbols, versus where you rely on your own internal standard of praiseworthiness, consulting that impartial spectator within your own breast. Which voice are you listening to most closely?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.